It seems unthinkable that parents who adopt a child would later try and give the child away to strangers they meet on the internet. But that's exactly what an investigation by Megan Tuohy of Reuters uncovered, an underground network of child swapping that's unregulated by authorities. In her series, The Child Exchange, she and the Reuters team found that parents of adopted children were offering them up on the internet an average of once a week. In at least one case, the child was given to a pedophile. Welcome to the Muck Reads podcast. My name is Marshall Allen, and I'm a reporter at ProPublica. I spoke to Tuohy about her investigation of this shadowy world, where children are rehomed in a manner that sounds more like people giving up their pets than sons or daughters. Tuohy spoke with parents who gave up their children and people who took them, and, of course, the children themselves. In this conversation, she provides the behind-the-scenes details of how she investigated the story. Megan, welcome to the podcast. Maybe you could start by giving us an overview of the series and what you discovered.
Well, this 18-month Reuters investigation uncovered basically a largely lawless, unregulated, participants themselves call it underground network where people go to solicit new families for their unwanted adopted children.
And how did you first learn about this? I mean, basically, people who had adopted children from most of them international adoptions, the children, many of them had behavioral, emotional issues, things like that. Or for whatever reason, the adoptive parent decided they didn't want the child anymore, couldn't handle them anymore. They find complete strangers on the internet. How did you discover this?
To begin with, I was interested in international adoption, and you know, in recent years, there has been coverage of some of the problems that have surfaced, have been uncovered on the foreign end of international adoptions. You know, it's really been only in the last 15 years that some of these countries have opened their orphanages to Americans looking to adopt. And in certain countries, Americans have kind of flooded in. And you know, there's been 250,000 foreign children adopted and brought back to the United States. And what we've learned in recent years is that there have been problems on the foreign end, that there's been child trafficking and fraud as Americans have sort of flooded these certain countries and their child welfare systems. And so I figured that if there were problems happening on the foreign end, there were likely repercussions and ripple effects here in the United States. So with that in mind, I went online and started just researching international adoption and what was happening here in the United States. And I really just stumbled into these Yahoo groups and other online forums where desperate parents were going to offer up their adopted children to solicit new families, and where people were going to basically raise their hand and say, hey, I'll take your kids. And I thought, well, we've got to investigate this further.
What did these posts read like? How would they make the pitch?
It depends. I mean, one of the most valuable things I think about this project was I worked with our database team. We basically did a deep dive on one of the Yahoo groups where it's called rehoming activity takes place. And we scraped all 5,000 messages going back 5 years and built a database where we were able to quantify what was going on. And, you know, we logged every single offer of a child that was being made over a 5-year period and found that on average, a child was being offered up once a week. People, families from all across the country were doing this. And, you know, roughly 70% of the kids were said to have been foreign born. A chunk of them were said to have suffered from special needs of some kind. So there were also kids who were described as having, you know, suffered from sexual abuse. So, you know, we were able to get that information because in a lot of these posts, in a lot of these solicitations for new families for the child, there were somewhat detailed descriptions of the kids, details about their histories of sexual abuse. You know, some of these ads, you know, we point out that it's interesting to note, too, that the term rehoming was first used to describe people seeking new owners for their pets. And some of the ads read sort of remarkably similar to the ads that you'd see for people trying to find a new home for their pet. You know, some of the ads would describe kids as being obedient, eager to please, pretty. Yeah, talk about them being pretty.
I know. I saw, you know, they said, we get compliments on our good looks all the time,
right.
Things like that.
Right.
This story really resonated with me in part because my oldest son is adopted from Korea. And when you adopt a child, You swear in a court of law to provide your child the same rights and benefits as a biological child would have in your family. So it's really stunning that adoptive parents are disregarding their responsibilities this way. and then putting their children at such incredible risk. I mean, you documented one case of a child who went into the home of a man who was later convicted of sexual offenses, right? He's now a registered sex offender. So I'm reading this as a parent. I think a lot of the audience, this is so stunning. People are reading it as parents. But as a journalist, when you saw this, what were the first thoughts that went through your mind when you saw these postings?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I spent probably a good month poring through all of the messages in this one particular rehoming group. And, you know, I think that people have a variety of reactions. I think one of the strengths of the story is in the way that we presented it on the Reuters website. We really paid a lot of attention. We wanted the story to have a lot of multimedia components. So we actually built an interactive where readers themselves can click on every single offer of a child made in this one particular group and, you know, have their own reactions to the ads. And I do think that they're powerful. And I think that, you know, if you read through the ads, and then I also did a lot of interviews of adoptive parents who have rehomed a child, and there were definitely some major themes that came through. It was clear that a lot of these parents felt desperate. You know, they had, you know, adopted these children, oftentimes not knowing that they were going to come with severe emotional or behavioral problems. When things went south, you know, they turned to their adoption agencies, and you know, the adoption agencies refused to help. They went to the state child welfare systems, you know, and were told that if they wanted tried to relinquish their child to the state, that they could be charged with abuse or neglect and, you know, jeopardize the other children in their home. And, you know, that they really turned to this, you know, largely underground network to rehome their child because they felt like they had nowhere else to turn. And, you know, so I think that there was, you know, once again, a lot of desperation. And in many cases, these parents had nowhere else to turn, that they weren't, that nobody was helping them.
So where did you start once you saw the message boards, you saw the ads? How did you begin to untangle the web of relationships that eventually led to the series?
Right. It was one thing to spend time in these online forums and to sort of see the online activity. Obviously, we realized that we needed to kind of leap out of the group and into the real world and to find people who had experienced this, especially the kids. That was a real top priority for me, is getting to whom this had happened. And there are no laws that recognize that rehoming is taking place, let alone address it. There's no government agency tracking this activity. And what happens to these kids, you know, they're really largely anonymous in the country's child welfare system. That was probably the biggest challenge, was making the leap out of the online activity into the real world and going on the search for families who had done this, and, you know, especially the children to whom this had happened. And, you know, there were a variety of ways that I went about that. The series ends up focusing in large part on this one particular couple, Nicole and Calvin Eason, who had obtained at least six children through the underground network. And, you know, I heard about them on the Yahoo group that we did a deep dive on. There were warnings about them. There were people who were going online and saying, hey, watch out for this couple. They're dangerous. They move around. They take kids.
And they use their names.
And they use their names. They spelled differently. I thought if I could sort of find who they were, that there was likely an interesting sort of story that could be part of the series there. So
how did you find them?
That was difficult, actually.
Yeah, these are people they've moved from state to state in recent years.
And right. I couldn't even find them through a regular Google search. I thought I was never going to find them, to be honest. But I sort of slowly, I don't even remember exactly how I figured out who exactly they were. But once I did, I started kind of going to the various jurisdictions where they had lived and going to the police departments and the county courthouses and pulling any and all records that I could get on them.
Was this all on the ground stuff, or were you able to do some of this online, or a mixture of both?
I definitely spent a lot of time on the phone with county courthouses across the country, which I think investigators know can be very tiring.
How many locations? Process. How many locations are we talking about?
Oh, here? This is a couple who had moved from Massachusetts to South Carolina to Illinois to New York to Florida and Arizona, where I ultimately found them. And they had moved; they had lived in different jurisdictions in those various places. So I really, really tried to track down every single government agency that could possibly have public records on them in all of those jurisdictions, and spent a lot of time on the phone with county courthouses, the kind of places that say, well, you know, we'll run a search for you if you send us a check for $100.
Right.
We'll run the name through the system, and then it's going to be like 3 months before you possibly get the records that are going to cost you $600.
What were you able to learn from all this?
I was able to start to piece together an interesting background on them. I discovered that, she had her own biological children removed by social services about 10 years ago, for findings of, you know, abuse, neglect. One official had described them, she and her husband, as suffering from severe psychiatric problems with violent tendencies. I found that in the next couple years, she and her husband had both been accused of sexually abusing children that they babysat. There weren't charges, but there were allegations.
How a lot of times these allegations aren't public record. So where did those kind of things turn up?
The allegations themselves turned up in South Carolina police reports.
Okay, police reports. Mm-hmm. All right.
Police reports. Sometimes, you know, police reports would make references to child welfare records that, as all investigative reporters or reporters of any kind know, that securing records from child welfare agencies is, like, extremely difficult.
Right.
And so, for me, one of the biggest breakthroughs came when I was able to piece together some of their kind of criminal background and what had happened with their biological children, but to really break through into what had been happening with their rehoming activity was, you know, the real challenge. And there aren't records kept on this rehoming activity.
Yeah,
no government agencies checking
trail.
This. Yeah. So ultimately, there was a child welfare agency in one of the states where they had lived, and I was able to obtain some of those internal records that they had on a rehoming case where one of the children that the Easons took went missing. They basically vanished and set off an interstate search, and there were officials in four states involved, and the FBI became aware. That was a big breakthrough, I'd say, getting those internal records.
So it's always interesting, when you do one of these kinds of stories and you have somebody in mind who you're really kind of investigating around the outside a little more, right, trying to find out what you can find on background before you go to the person themselves. So how did you first approach Nicole and Calvin Easson? Tell us, what was that like?
It was remarkable. There was this kind of breakthrough moment where I got these child protective records from one state that then sort of provided a roadmap to all these other rehoming cases that I knew that they had been involved with. And I was able to figure out, you know, the adoptive parents who had turned children over to them and exactly how those transfers had taken place. By the time that I went to go talk to them, to, you know, tried to interview them, I knew a lot about them. I knew that they were living in Tucson, Arizona. And so I traveled out there with my editor, Blake Morrison, who was just like a total superstar supportive editor at the end. I mean, we thought it was wise for two of us to go.
Well, they could be dangerous, right? You don't know anything about these people other than some things that are unseemly, to say the least. So did you just drive up to their house or what?
It took some effort once we were out in Tucson to find exactly where they were living. And I had gotten a hold of her on the phone. You know, I approached her in the way that I approach pretty much anybody I talk to for a story and said, hey, I'm looking at the rehoming of adopted children. I understand that you've taken children in this manner and have been active in this world, and I'd like to talk to you about your experience. And so we ended up sitting down on her couch and talking with her for about an hour and a half. You know, I went back that later that afternoon and her husband was home and, you know, talked to him for about an hour and a half, asking very straightforward questions. And we've had some subsequent interviews being pretty straightforward with the questioning.
Did they have any idea how much you knew about their background during this time? I assume that they had no idea, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, you can be certain that by the time we had finished all of our interviews, they knew absolutely everything that we were going to say.
Course,
in fact,
sure.
I took a trip at the very end, right before the story was about to be published. NBC had decided to come on board, and we partnered with them for the last stretch of the project. So I traveled out to Tucson to try to meet with the Easons for the last time with NBC correspondent Kate Snow. and a cameraman, which in that moment, the Eason's refused to talk to me and Kate. At that point, we had a list of every single thing we were going to say in the story about her and about her husband, all of the facts that we'd gathered.
No surprises.
And so, yes, this happened on camera. You know, I handed to her a list of absolutely everything that we had learned and that we intended to publish and said, you know, listen, if you want to.
Correct us if this is wrong.
Yeah,
please.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, but we were pretty obsessive of wanting to make sure that actually every single person in the story knew exactly what was going to be, what was going to be coming.
Now, I want to talk about the parents who gave up their children, because that also was incredible that you had this these people on the record and matter-of-factly saying and explaining, yes, I gave my child to Nicole Eason. How did you identify them, and then how did you get them to talk to you? It seems like they would not want to, but what do you think their motivation was?
Well, as I said before, I think that, you know, a major theme that comes through if you examine this this world of rehoming is the desperation and frustration that the adoptive parents have felt.
Right.
And so when a reporter comes knocking on their door and says, I want to talk to you about your experience, I think a lot of them were actually eager to talk about the frustrations and desperation that they had experienced. And these are people who felt like, said that they felt like the system had really ignored them. The, you know, once the adoptions went sour, they felt like the adoption industry had ignored them. They felt like the state child, you know, the government child welfare system had ignored them. So the fact that there was a reporter who wanted to sit down and talk to them about what they had experienced and what they did. And think in some cases they wanted to talk.
Yeah, that's what adds to the complexity of the story, is the failure of the support system for people who are in this situation. They felt conflicted too, right?
I think that, you know, if you read the series, the voices of those families, that they speak for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And then the children, obviously the ones being passed around in this case, and you're able to identify and track them down and get them on the record. How did you go about doing that, and what did you find when you spoke to some of these children?
Mm-hmm. I'd say this sort of same thing applied to a lot of the children. These were kids who had undergone a lot in their lives, and I think that they were grateful to have the opportunity to talk about what had happened to them and what they had experienced. You know, I didn't do this just by the phone, you know, just over the phone.
Right.
This was really a story where I, you know, traveled around the country and met with these kids sometimes more than once, would, you know, talk to them on a very regular basis to make sure that they felt comfortable every step of the way. You know, if there's themes that come out when you talk to these parents, there's also themes that come out when you talk to these young folks who have experienced this. And I think while it was very difficult for many of them to revisit what had happened to them, they many of them also seemed very eager to speak out in a way that, you know, if they thought it could help other kids. And so I think that was a motivating factor for a lot of them. And
can you talk about the importance of staying independent when we do these kinds of stories, and whether or not, you know, you wrestled with that in terms of just reporting on something so emotional, but then obviously needing to stay distanced and independent.
Right. Yes. I mean, I think that it's clear that this story has, from the response that we've been getting at Reuters this week, that it is a story that people have a very sort of strong emotional response to. And, you know, one of the nicer compliments, I think, has been people have described it as that the writing was somewhat understated and that we didn't try to use any gimmicks or anything to try to pump up the emotional factor. I mean, I think after 18 months of sort of the relentless pursuit of facts that, you know, as is the case with all investigative journalism, the best thing you can do is just present the facts in a very straightforward way. You know, leave it up to readers to have a response. So
now, one of the real strengths of the stories, I think, or the series, is the way you structured it around this one individual network. But it had me wondering as I was reading it, did you find, are there other networks out there that you stumbled upon that, you know, when you're doing a narrative, you just want to restrict it to something that people can really understand? But were there any signs of other things like this out there?
You mean other rehoming networks or other networks?
Well, or even other people like Nicole and Calvin Eason who are really gathering children and have a background that is obviously questionable.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. The structuring of the story, I mean, it was, I've never worked on something for 18 months, and I just felt so grateful to be at a news organization where I got the support to do that, and I was able to, you know, in the months leading up to this, say, you know, turns out there's a kid in Texas, and, you know, be put on a plane to go capture that story. When it came time to actually write the story, that was just a whole nother phase with a whole new set of challenges because we had so much. And what were we going to leave out and how were we going to structure this? And so there was quite a bit that got left on the, you know, on the cutting board. And I think that I'm looking forward to, you know, continuing to report. You know, you're going to see more on this from Reuters.
Okay.
Yeah, there's definitely more there.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming in and just telling us a little bit behind the scenes. It's fascinating, and it's a huge public service that you all did and you did with your reporting. Thank you for that.
Thanks so much.
That was Megan Tuohy of Reuters. You can read her entire investigation on the Reuters website. For ProPublica, I'm Marshall Allen. Thanks for listening.